is the Gays and Lesbians of Zimbabwe, or GALS, Programs Manager for Gender, Fadzai Muparuta. She joins us from Harare to discuss the reports of the new violence against the gay community and the history of the struggle for basic human rights in Zimbabwe. Welcome on the program, Fadzai.
Thank you very much, Viola.
Now, let's start with the issue of corrective rape. What exactly is this?
Well, people have a certain belief that particularly men towards women who present themselves as masculine, if they have sex with a man, then they will appreciate male sex and want to be in heterosexual relationships. So the idea behind it is that you rape someone and you correct their sexual feelings towards people of the same sex. So putting it in that way means that people think that it's something that is positive and it is corrective, but what it is in fact is very negative because it is rape. And putting a term like corrective in front of it or curative before the word rape is in some way desensitizing the kind of violations or the kind of violence that lesbians or...
You cannot go against nature, because when you do, go against nature, it's part of nature too. Our little lives get complicated. It's a simple thing, simple as a flower, and that's a complicated thing.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking, right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, your free-thinking historian and executive director of CFI Vancouver.
And this is Don, your political scientist philosopher.
This is Rob, cognitive psychologist.
And this is Daniel, president of the UBC Freethinkers Club and economics student here at UBC.
Well, gentlemen, how's your week been?
Well, deja vu all over again. As we will probably explain later, we've had another incident with our podcasting.
Some of you may have heard last week's show if you listened to the podcast, or at least about the last 16 minutes of it.
Yeah, another technical hiccup here at CITR. Our podcast went out, but only about 19 minutes, and only about the last 12 minutes actually had any content. So our apologies to our loyal listeners. Hopefully that won't happen again. And for your benefit, we're going to review some of those topics onto this today's show.
And if you're listening live, not everything we're going to talk about is the same as last time. There's going to be a couple new stories, so that's
and
good.
With any luck, it'll actually be more polished than it was last time.
Plus, we've learned so much this last week.
We really have. We learn and move on here on Radio Free Thinker. And speaking of learning, Daniel, what's going on with pediatricians?
Well, a recent study done by Dr. Aidsman, which was presented at a pediatric conference in Vancouver just about a week ago, he looked into old wives' tales and whether they influence pediatricians. He gave them a whole bunch of myths and a few things that were true, so the answer wouldn't be no to everything. He sent this out to about 5,000 pediatricians, and about 1,000 responded. From that, some kind of scary statistics came out. Most of the myths, in fact, are fairly harmless. It's not going to really hurt your child, but it'd be better if your pediatrician knew the correct answer. So in this case, one of them was one-third of pediatricians think that unbandaging a wound to expose it to air speeds up healing. Fairly harmless if you do that, but it is better to keep the bandage on.
I was just going to ask what kinds of examples of harmless myths there are. But I'm assuming there's a few things that people believe that aren't actually harmless.
Yes. A few of those, and it, This is where it gets a little scary. At least a third of the doctors got at least one of these wrong, and 13% got three or more wrong out of the 12 myths that could have serious consequences. One of these is that it's okay to treat a burn with ice. About a third of doctors said it's okay, and this can actually quite seriously damage skin in the long term. And even worse, one third of doctors said it is okay to put a baby to sleep on its side, and this can cause crib death, otherwise sometimes known as sudden infant death syndrome. What he found is that new doctors and old doctors got the most incorrect, and that's doctors with less than 5 years medical experience or more than 30 years. I'm just making this up right now, but I guess it's because newer doctors haven't had the time to confront a lot of these with their patients, and older doctors might not have or might have been around when some of these were more common treatments.
Could it be, too, like it's cultural artifacts, right? I mean, old doctors, again, have the old cultural things. And new doctors, well, I mean, they just grew up, right? They're the little kids. And mom said, hey, take that off. And they still haven't quite had enough.
They are called old wives' tales for a reason.
Yes. And this kind of brings up an interesting question about Western medicine and science-based medicine in general. It's not perfect. It does have issues. People still, these doctors still succumb to bad cures and stuff, but they question each other. They look for better answers, and they strive towards finding the best treatments they can that are most effective and backed by science, unlike homeopaths.
You know, I'm just kind of curious about I imagine the cognitive dissonance going on in some of these doctors' heads. I mean, they've obviously gone through medical school. They know the science behind how a wound heals itself. So they should logically know that giving it air is not going to help its healing process. In fact, they should know that it's going to hamper the healing process.
Well, most people's beliefs aren't always consistent with each other. The cognitive dissonance arises when you're getting information from outside that conflicts with a sort of automatic belief that you have, or a heuristic. And usually the heuristic is going to win out over some new piece of information that you haven't yet integrated into the way you look at the world.
Right.
The lead author of the study, Dr. Aidsman, he thought of this after he realized that when his kids were growing up, him and his wife, who are both Ivy League educated physicians, did some of these things with their children. For instance, they wouldn't let them swim for 30 minutes after eating, and there's no scientific reason to do that. It's just culturally ingrained. So they wanted to figure out how many pediatricians actually say things like this.
I'd be interested to find out if there's any study even remotely like this put out by, you know, naturopathic physicians asking how many of their practitioners believe something that isn't based in evidence.
A 100%?
I'm curious, Daniel, where was the study done?
I believe it was a North American study.
Okay. So not specifically Canadian or American?
No. I couldn't actually find the full study because, as I said, it just came out like days ago, and I couldn't find it on Google Scholar for whatever reason, but I believe it is North American.
Interesting. Well, I mean, that probably is consistent, though, with, I think, a lot of our own experiences with medicine and sort of the combination that you get sort of folkloric healing remedies in there as well. For example, grandma's chicken soup to cure the common cold, right?
Though I believe there have been some studies done into the curative properties of chicken soup, and they found...
Yeah, there is something in there, obviously, yeah.
And maybe, of course, too, there's that whole buy-in thing, right? You know, if you're actively doing something, you somehow feel like it's got to be better than if you don't do anything. It's like taking a bandage off. It's simple, it doesn't help, but, I mean, you've done something as opposed to not doing something.
Of course. I don't know. As a skeptic, though, you should... I shouldn't say you should completely doubt everything your doctor says, but, I mean, look stuff up sometimes, get second opinions. They're not perfect.
I doubt that.
I just remember this really scary story that I heard years ago about this guy who got the flesh-eating disease bacteria because he cut his finger on his suitcase zipper and didn't put a Band-Aid on it, and it ended up getting infected, and he got flesh-eating disease, and that just scared me straight, so... Any cut, no matter how small, I wrap it in like five layers of bandages and pour alcohol on it, and yeah, the whole shebang.
Drink the rest?
Yes.
Yeah, well, yeah, obviously.
It's good for you.
Well, Don, you were telling me about the kludge?
Yes.
Or is it the kludge?
Kludge, kludge. If there's a linguistic student or an English major out there, you could please email us the correct pronunciation of it. I'll go with kludge for the moment because that is the dominant view.
Yeah, we've only ever actually seen it written down, and I've never heard anyone say it. So let us know at radio.freethinker@gmail.com.
I was... The origin of this story is I was listening to New York Times, Science Times, and they had this article about genes. As people may or may not remember, the one of the goals of the Millennium Project for the United States was the mapping of the human genome. This was accomplished, actually, almost right on 2000. But sadly, having known what the genes were didn't actually tell us what they did. In an attempt to discover more about how genes actually work, geneticists are using evolution to help point the way. Nature, unlike mythology, can't create things out of nothing. Evolution is the triumph of the kludge. Kludge, it's an engineering term, basically means it's a workaround, quick and dirty, sort of inelegant but very effective solution to a problem where you take existing parts and you rework them to do something new. Our genes are like this.
Kind of like using duct tape to fix something.
The idea being that it's sort of bodged together, not really planned out in advance, but sort of, all right, I need something that does this right now. Let's cobble it together out of spare parts and stuff that kind of works, and there we go.
If anyone's seen the movie Apollo 13, I believe at one point the NASA ground control had a box full of stuff, and they put it onto the table and said, this is what we got to work with to solve the problem that was in the...
I was just going to say, Daniel, it sounds like you've watched a lot of the Red Green Show.
I've watched a little bit of The Red Dream.
A little bit, enough to know about duct tape, yeah.
Duct tape forever.
Okay, now getting us back to where we were going. We've all evolved, those of us who believe in evolution and are rational, that we evolved from more primitive organisms. And our genes are their genes. Although they no longer necessarily do the same thing, they're still in there. But they're doing different work. Researchers... we're looking at a set of 5 genes that are used to make human blood. They found these same network of genes in the yeast cell. But in the yeast cell, they perform a totally different function. They actually are used to help repair cells.
So hold on. They found the exact same genetic sequence in the human genome and in a yeast cell?
Yes. They have the technical term is gene modules. Now... again, it's the same. I mean, it makes some sense, right? I mean, the genes are in there, and they're just being adapted to different uses. And actually, that's what they said. So in the yeast cell, these genes create enzymes and proteins that are used to repair the cell. Having found these genes and knowing what they're doing in the yeast, and we understand the yeast cell very, very well. We understand what its genes are doing pretty much for everywhere. They found that these 5 cells worked with some other cells. I'm going to say another 5 genes. I forget the exact number. In doing this repair job on the cells. Then they took these new 5 genes that they learned of from the E-cell and looked for them in the human genome and discovered those same 5 cells there and helping to make blood vessels. Now this research is really big because one, it helps us identify what the genome is, and having identified what the genes do, you can develop new gene therapies. This particular one was with regards to cancer and trying to stop the blood flow that cancers need in order to grow. Now, there's some weird things, too, that go along with this. I mean, some of the things that they've discovered, that some of them are obvious. Light-sensing organs in jellyfish are related to human eyes, which kind of makes some sense. The scaffolding for a thing called a cenoflagellate, or it's a unicell... eucalyte. It's like one of those little single-cell microorganisms you see on science shows. Well, the thing that's used to create its scaffolding for its body is the same genes that are used to create scaffolding for neurons. And that was quite cool. They found some links between deafness and plants. Just the same genes that result in deafness in humans are also found in plants. Same thing with breast cancer and nematode worms.
What does it make the plants deaf, or what does the deafness gene do in plants?
Well, no, see, that's a great question to ask, because the whole point of this is that the genes in the plants do an entirely different job, right? It's the same genes working together that allows us to look at the human genome and say, okay, we know these 2 genes cause deafness in humans. What do these genes do in the plants? And if they're finding something that has, it happens to be a plant that they discovered the same two genes into, right? Now, in the plant, these two genes are used, again, they didn't tell exactly, but I'm going to make something up here. Those same two genes are used to make the scaffolding for the plant's veins and its leaves. Well, we know in the plant that those two genes work with three or four other genes. So maybe all these five genes work together. So then they go back to the human, where they have the two genes, and they're now looking for these three other new genes that they discovered in the plant. And they now know five genes that are involved in this deafness, and maybe there's a way to get around that.
So it's not as simple as simply turning these genes on in the plant and it will grow ears or something.
No, and actually the two real big things I think are fantastic about this.
Unless it's corn.
Well done, sir.
Is one, I mean, it's one of those really strong proofs of evolution. I mean, we have the same genes. I mean, if we were all created, there would be no purpose to have kludge genes, sorry. Getting dirty looks in here for using the wrong pronunciation.
Well, we don't know which one is the right one.
Yes. We're just all biased.
The second thing is this is such a good indirect way to learn something about the human genome. Because, again, we don't understand a lot about the human genome, but we understand a lot about a lot of other simpler forms of life. And we can take that knowledge to find out new things about ourselves. Because, again, we have this evolutionary link.
I just want to go back to the proof of evolution point. And a lot of the time you'll hear creationists say, well, everything about humans is way too complicated to have just randomly come about, and that's about the extent of their argument against evolution. But this so clearly shows that we're not very perfect. In fact, like, the genes that do most of this complicated stuff in us does simpler things in other things, and it just happens to work together with other ones to do complicated things with us. It's not like brand new genes had to pop out to create eyes. Genes just kind of came together, and it's not nearly as improbable.
Well, and to go on with that, I think another big issue we have is the whole idea of time scale. You know, I mean, we live, if we're lucky, 100 some odd years, right? But I mean, even if there's just these minor little changes, like the yeast cell turning into a blood cell sort of thing, or the genes doing it, right? Seems phenomenal, impossible to do in a human lifetime, and it probably is impossible. But you give it thousands, millions, maybe billion a year to do that kind of thing, then it doesn't seem hardly improbable at all. When you consider the number of generations you have to evolve, even little, tiny, minor little changes can have astronomical effects.
To the point where sometimes you don't even need changes. I mean, if these genes are, in fact, the exact same sequence in a human blood cell as compared to a yeast cell, then there didn't even need to be evolution.
True. And not to oversell this, though, and you're pointing to something interesting, Rob, is that they're looking for, like I say, similar modules of genes. Not all our genes are exactly the same as the yeast cell. Not all the yeast cells exactly. There are these happenstances. That's why, again, they're having to look at other animals to find the similar genes, because depending on their path of evolution, certain things will change in different ways, and you don't find always the same gene modules.
Well, that's pretty fascinating. Why don't we go to a commercial break, and when we come back, we will have Daniel's report, because he went undercover into the heart of a Mormon temple. Dum, dum, dum,
dum, dum. Then there's the utter misery that is college radio, where they apparently just let any bewildered freshman wander into the booth and try to run a radio station. Campus Outreach is looking for... Hang on. College radio can pretty much be summed up in five words.
CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Langley, the place where I grew up and the start of British Columbia's Bible Belt. The perfect place in BC for the newest and silly religious extravagance, this time by the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, which is more commonly known as the Mormon Church, and the opening of their first Pacific Northwest temple. While they briefly had it open to the public, I went on a tour. While pulling into this large compound owned by the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, all I could think was, wow, the place is huge, with the sprawling parking lot providing more than enough parking to allow for the thousands of visitors that have been visiting the temple daily. But unlike most large parking lots, the whole compound is beautiful. The landscaping is adorned with flowers and grass and is truly inviting. Walking into the meeting house, which is far more like a traditional church than the temple itself, I was met by at least 10 different volunteers, who I assume were the members of the local congregation. They were all friendly, but it still caused somewhat of an eerie vibe. There were probably over 200 volunteers in and around the temple directing traffic, directing people, and standing around whispering to each other. I was ushered into what seemed to be the largest room they had, which was comparable to a medium-sized Christian church you could find anywhere. There we were given a short speech about how happy local Mormons are to finally have a temple close to them. We then watched a very slick 12-minute video talking about Mormon persecution and how they finally managed to make their first temple after over 40 years. I'm not going to go too much into their history, but needless to say, they conveyed it very similar to how many other religions portray overcoming persecution. Throughout the production and the video, we were constantly reminded of how important the temple is to the Mormon faith. Wedding, baptisms, and many other rituals are done only in temples, or at least mostly in temples. I couldn't help but notice the subdued sales pitch that reverberated throughout the tour. They, of course, deny that the open houses are intended in any way to convert people, but I have strong doubts that that is actually true. Throughout the tour, we were constantly being bombarded with I statements about how wonderful being a member of the church is, and about how wonderful having a temple is. Anyone who has ever worked in sales knows that using I statements to extol the virtues of something is a classic and effective way of selling. The temple itself was pretty spectacular. It pretty much had to be, considering its rumored price tag of $33 million, which compares to about $2 million for their meeting house, which isn't much smaller in terms of square feet. It's a shame that the temple is now off limits to all but a selected group of Mormons, as it is beautiful. Their baptistry room looked like the world's most expensive spa. It is basically a small pool of water sitting on the backs of 12 bulls that represent the 12 tribes of Jerusalem. It is stunning. Another beautiful room is the Celestial Room, which is probably the largest room in the temple where people go to meditate and pray. I could go on about how beautiful this temple is, but I won't bore all of you. Instead, I just want to touch on the cost again. While $33 million certainly gets you a beautiful temple, it just seems completely insane to spend so much money on a building that has so few uses and is so secretive and off-limits. And on top of that, it seems so ridiculous that the Township of Langley allows them to be tax-exempt, at least partly, on what amounts to such an extravagant and secretive building.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker. Daniel, that was scary as hell.
You know, actually, Daniel, before you start into that, $33 million, holy poop. I have to wonder, I mean, how do they afford that? We had an article a little while ago about a town and their tax-exempt status. How does $33 million, do they pay taxes on that, or are they one of these tax cheats?
Well, I decided to look into that, and mostly what I figured out is it's really, really hard to understand the Township of Langley's tax code and such, but it appears that they don't pay any tax on the temple or their meeting house, although there is a really nice house on the lot that I think they do pay for, but yeah, that's a lot of money worth of tax exemption that they're getting.
I think, if I'm correct, that if the minister or priest, I'm not sure what the Mormon church has, if he lives in that house, that can also be considered church lands, although it is a bit more dicier of a situation.
Maybe. I just can't say for sure.
So they don't have to pay taxes on this, but they also prevent most people from coming in and using it?
Yes. When they had it open to the public for these tours, pretty much anyone was welcome. You had to be modestly dressed, and I mean, technically they could have refused anyone, but they seemed pretty open, and I hadn't heard of any problems. But Yeah, now, as of May 2nd, I believe it was, it has been some fancy Mormon word for, like, turning it all sacred and such, and now only people wearing white suits and dresses that happen to be high-level Mormons who have probably given them a lot of money can get in.
So essentially, taxpayer money, by extension through tax exemption, is allowing the Mormon Church to operate at a reduced rate, and they've barred a large chunk, I think we can fairly say a large chunk, of the population who pay those taxes from using their services that they provide to the community.
Oh, well more than a large chunk, an incredibly large chunk.
Like maybe 90%?
Way more than that. The temple is, according to their propaganda video, is going to serve 22,000 people from the Pacific Northwest, so that's not even just BC. Most of them aren't Township of Langley residents. Maybe like 1,000 people in Langley will ever go into that temple, probably even less. So it's basically Township of Langley giving them a break on something that hardly even serves Langley.
I can't believe nobody in Langley hasn't protested or complained or wrote to their mayor or something. I mean, this seems like a massive waste of taxpayer money and resources.
Actually, you know, this is another example. This is the bad side. You know, everyone talks about the separation of church and state, and we don't want the church interfering with state activities. Well, the flip side of that is that the state doesn't get to interfere in church activities. Or people say, well, it's church, it's religion. We're not supposed to make any comment or judgment about it, and that's why we can't criticize it. Although the Gibson test is pretty good, because, I mean, does it actually serve the community? And if I believe the Jehovah's Witnesses said, well, it only really serves to proselytize in our own little group, so it would fail in that group. So I'm agreeing with you, but I think the reason why people don't do it is we are instilled this idea of church and state as separate and coexistent, but they interfere with each other all the time, and here's an example of it going the other way.
As far as I could tell in Langley media and online, no one's even brought it up that it's tax exempt. Once again, I'm not smart at reading tax things, so maybe it's not, and I'm just an idiot. I'll post the link to where people can look at that if they might understand this better than me. But from what I can tell, yeah, pretty much fully tax exempt, and no one seems to care.
It's even worse, too, because, I mean, even I think as a Jehovah's Witness, you could go there just if you wanted to and say, well, let me listen to what you have to say. But you're saying you can't even do that at the Mormon temple. The Catholic churches, all the other churches, usually you can go there, even the Buddhist or Sikh temples, you can go there and sit in and listen. You might not care what they have to listen, but it's still open to the public, where this isn't even open to the public.
Yeah, that place, the number one thing you see there is lots of security equipment. There's, like, alarm systems everywhere, fences around it, a creepy-looking interview room that is right next to the front, which is like locked on the outside. It kind of scared me a little bit, but a
few people wander around orange jumpsuits, you know.
Well,
over their head.
No, they're white jumpsuits.
Well, I mean, you kind of just sort of touched on some really creepy aspects, but and maybe I'm remembering wrong, but I think some of the traditional services churches are supposed to provide to kind of give it that old-fashioned reason for why they have certain beneficial tax status is things like sanctuary and, you know, providing a shelter for people who have no place to go. I mean, could you just imagine someone being, like, chased by a mob, running up to, like, the Mormon temple, sanctuary, sanctuary! Sorry, you're not a Mormon. Close the door.
Yeah, I can't see them really providing anything.
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, like, what benefit do they provide to the community? I mean, we would expect this of any other charity.
The temple looks kind of nice from the outside.
Okay, well, that's kind of good.
That's all I got.
Well, the temple is barred from the public, but is their meeting house?
I'm not sure. I didn't hear anything about general public being allowed to, like, rent it out, but maybe. It's not considered sacred ground to them like the temple is, so it's not inconceivable that they might, but I honestly don't know.
I find it even doubly ironic in a way, because, I mean, not only they're keeping out the public, if I understand you correctly, they're even keeping out other Mormons, unless you happen to reach a certain level.
Yeah, they weren't specific on it, but they did say that you would only be allowed in if you were given permission by, like, the local Mormon head of the church. I don't know. From what I've heard, the Mormons do operate on somewhat of a Scientology-like system where money gets you places. If, for instance, the probably funded by Mormon groups, and basically what they did is they went to Mormons and said, okay, we know how much you make because we find that information out on you. You're going to give us X amount of your income if you want to be a Mormon anymore and you want to be in our temple. And so they do things like that, and I imagine that's going to be the same for the Langley Temple.
Wow. Well, why don't we shift gears to something a little less terribly scary, and we'll talk about cold fusion. What the heck is cold fusion?
Let me tell you what cold fusion is. Actually, to begin with, I have to tell you how I discovered this story. I was listening to NPR's Science Friday. As you know, I listen to everything all the time. And they had this gentleman on there named Michael McCubre. K-U-B-R-E. Sounds like a relative of McDonald's, but not quite. Anyhow, they were interviewing him because they had the annual convention of American chemists in February, I think it was. And apparently him, along with several other people, were presenting papers on cold fusion. Now, I remember cold fusion. It was, for a long time, seen as a quack science. It was, really had strong prejudice against the scientific community because when it first came out, it was seen as fakeness. Now, before I go into exact what cold fusion is, I'm going to give a brief primer on the whole idea of nuclear power. Cold fusion is supposed to be a form of nuclear power.
Nuclear. I've called you on this before. Nuclear. Say it clearly and you'll say it correctly, as my physics professor used to say.
And I'll just turn off Rob's mic so we cover up the big fist pounding into his face right now.
So going on with fission power.
Sorry.
Right now, actually, the current method we use right now is called fission. Basically, the idea of that is you take a big particle, you split it apart into smaller particles, and you get some energy. You also get some radioactive byproducts. This is sort of the technology you have in the atom bomb. Now, of course, the big problem with fission power is the waste products, i.e. nuclear waste. What do you do with it? And the fuel itself is somewhat rare. I mean, naturally, you can get uranium-235, but it's very small, hard to get. Or you can manufacture plutonium, but that's also very difficult. One of the things we've been trying to get is a thing called fusion. Now, fusion is the opposite of fission, although they sound almost identical. Fusion is where you take two small atoms, like hydrogen and water, and you slam them together, and you get a bigger atom, helium, and some energy, and there's no radioactive byproducts. This is essentially the technology of the sun. Now, of course, the big problem with this one is, as you may or may not know, the sun is slightly warm, and we have to recreate those conditions that are in the sun, and that presents a lot of problems. In 1989, two scientists named Pons and Felchman, mispronouncing that name too, Rob, would you like to correct me on that one? discovered what they called cold fusion, i.e. fusion energy, but at room temperature, so you didn't need the big apparatus to make the sun. And that this cold fusion could solve all the problems. However, when other labs tried to replicate their experiment, as any good science discovery has to do, it has to be replicable or it's not true, it failed. And so cold fusion and the scientists were all dropped. The term, like I say, was essentially seen as quack physics. It was seen like a perpetual motion machine.
It's basically become a joke in the realms of physics and chemistry. People talk about, you know, mad scientists trying to do cold fusion in the same breath as people who do, like you said, perpetual motion machines or trying to create, you know, lasers that can etch their name on the moon.
Yeah, it's also sort of become like a cautionary tale as well. Don't go to the media with your extraordinary claims until you've proven the extraordinary claims to the community.
It reminds me of companies like Steorn, who a couple of years ago said that they basically had perfected a method of getting lots and lots of energy without creating a lot of waste or anything like that. And they would say that they're going to present it to the public or to a team of scientists so that they can evaluate it. And every time they were going to show it off, something went wrong or somebody important didn't show up and they never did.
You guys are echoing what went on my mind exactly when I heard about this particular story. I mean, Science Friday, it's been a reputable thing. I've listened to a lot of it, all their stories. The articles were being presented to a reputable organization, the American Chemistry Society. There were a number of people. There was, I think, about 7 or 8 people presenting it from all around the world. So, I listened, and according to the article that I was listening to, apparently the problem with the experiment or the replication attempts were that the experiment was a lot more finicky than they thought it was originally. That the confirmation failed because the loading of the deuterium, it's a heavy form of hydrogen, and the matrix of the platinum coil.
Are you just like techno babbling Star Trek stuff? Well,
no, actually, yeah.
Bounce the graviton particle beam off the main deflector dish.
No, actually, yeah, that's what I mean. Like you say, when I was listening to you, said, you needed to load the deuterium for longer, and that the platinum matrix catalyst had to be constructed in particular. I'm going, I don't know this, but I'm trusting that the scientists knew, because again, this is the thing. But apparently, that's where the issue lied. It wasn't that it failed, it's that the setup for the experiments were more simple than they needed to be. They're actually very complex, and that the phenomena has been repeated several times.
So this cold fusion-like or cold fusion actual phenomenon only occurs in very specific conditions, and all the attempts to replicate it hadn't replicated the same conditions.
We kind of have a chicken and the egg sort of thing. When everyone tried to initially repeat the experiment, they failed because they weren't exact enough. But because there was actual real kind of science behind it, right? I mean, they knew there was kind of something going on. They just couldn't figure out what, because Pons and Fleischmann were accredited. They were very valid scientists at the time. So the scientific method wins out in the end. And people kept hitting it. Say, well, let's try it different. Let's try it this way. And since the experiment, people have been slowly been able to replicate the experiment. There is one video of it on screen.
So, how far away are we from actually using cold fusion?
Well, you see, the big problem they actually have, and this was part of the problem originally, is that this form of fusion has no theoretical foundation. So they see the effect, right? And there is apparently an excess of helium heat and tritium emissions. Ooh, I'm getting out my big dictionary today. So they know there's something there, but they're not really sure what's the theoretical foundation of it. That's part of the problem. One of the ideas is the idea of bubble fusion. Bubble fusion is the idea is where you have a bubble and it collapses so quickly and with enough power that you create little mini fusion reactions in them. But they're not really sure if that's it. So the theory is still behind. And that's why scaling these effects up, making them into generators, is still a bit of a long ways away. But again, one of the things I loved about this, and it kind of counters those people who think there's a big conspiracy against whatever quack thing they're doing, if there's real science behind it, the science will eventually win out, because science is real. So even if the whole, and you heard us talk at the beginning of this, the whole physics system, institutions, were against cold fusion. It was seen as total quack. But the real science was still in there, and someone was saying, okay, maybe, and they're working at it, and it comes out.
Interesting. Well, why don't we go to commercial break on Radio Free Thinker, and we'll be back with some more.
CITR has more friends than ever before. We've partnered with tons of local businesses to bring you great discounts in the communities where you live, work, and play. Maybe Main Street is your main drag. Present your Friends of CITR card at Red Cat Records, Lucky's Comics, Devil May Wear, Thriller, Blim, Hotbox, The Kiss Store, The Wallflower Modern Diner, RX Comics, Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Vinyl Records, Regional Assembly of Text, and Twig and Hottie to receive fabulous discounts. So become a CITR member, get a free friends card, and feel the love.
A long time ago, in a city far, far away,
CITR
was born. In the decade ahead, America will be in space.
CITR
is already there. Astronaut Neil Armstrong had this to say about
CITR.
It's one small step for man.
CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
Herbert R. Tarlick, Chairman.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker. And we're going to go over Deepak Chopra again, because it's just that important, people. It's just that important.
Well, actually, you know, it's one of those things, you know, why are we going to do it? Because, you know, I feel shame for my adopted hometown here. Because Deepak is coming to Vancouver in June. This is a return engagement for him, because he was here earlier in February, and I guess it was so successful, they had to come back and take more money out of people's pockets.
If you've lived in Kits at all, you'll find no surprise in this.
For those who aren't familiar, Deepak Chopra is one of the top performers in what I call woo-woo. And I use that term specifically, if you've ever seen online, he does a debate with Michael Shermer and Sam Harris, and they use the term woo-woo, and oh, it gets under his belt when you use the word woo-woo. Bugs him. So, he is a practitioner of woo-woo.
Take that, Chopra.
Woo-woo.
Today, though, we're going to talk about him in three sort of different ways. One, the idea of Big Alt Med, which he's a major moneymaker, how he redefines cultural terms, and lastly, his misuse of scientific terms and mispronunciation of mispronunciations. Okay, so let's get started.
Nuclear.
Let's start with the huge money-making industry that preys on the ill health of others. No, I don't mean Big Pharma. I mean Big Alt Med.
I believe it's also called Big Placebo by Michael Spector, who just wrote...
Yeah, and some people call it Scam.
Yes.
Complementary and alternative medicine with an S in front of it.
Yes, but let's all remember that we are a unique and innovative podcast, so...
And we should engage in ad hominem attacks until we review the evidence.
So, Alt Med is a multi-billion-dollar multinational corporate industry that profits on largely discrediting real medicine and takes advantage, this is editorial, of those who are confused, desperate, and or suffering. One of the big winners of the AltMed lottery is Deepak Chopra, who in 2007 had a salary of $22 million and was ranked 82nd on Forbes' most well-paid people that year.
I would kill for that kind of money.
So, watch out, that does.
You know, Deepak's, he believes in alternative medicine, and he has a clinic, and the actual things that the clinic does, it's based on what's called
Ayurvedic medicine,
which is a form of traditional Indian medicine that's centered on meditation, diet, and herbal supplements. His clinic offers, for example, a 10-day retreat that features this meditation and lectures on diet and Deepak's metaphysics, and it only costs you, anyone? How much for 10 days?
$10,000?
$6,000.
Well, let's remember, this includes two lunches, no other meals, not room and board. This is just going there for a couple hours during the day.
Two lunches?
Yeah, actually, I looked at that and it seemed pretty weird because, again, a big part of this is the health aspects of it. So it's a little less than $5,000 for the 10 days. So maybe he's not ripping people off as much as we think he is, but still, that seems like an awful lot for...
That's more than a year of tuition, so...
for two lunches.
Yeah.
Right, so...
And some lectures.
So what sorts of services does he actually provide for that kind of money?
Well, actually, you know, it's funny. He has this thing, it's called the Panchakarma, P-A-N-C-H-A-K-A-R-M-A, Panchakarma, must be it, which uses to detoxify the body and mind. He's obviously a dualist because he thinks they're separate. The method that he does is he applies or makes you eat a bunch of oils and other things to quote-unquote loosen and mobilize accumulated toxins. You go, okay, they're immobilized. What do I do now? Then he has what they call daily bastis. Boy, it's hard using these funny words, but they're appropriate. B-A-S-T-I-S. Now, he uses that word all over this one section. And I'm going, well, what is this? What is this? So I looked it up, and apparently it's an enema.
Oh.
So basically, they pump you full of oil, and they flush out your rear end.
What is with alt med and enemas?
I know. It's a huge thing.
To use a turn of phrase, they're really just blowing it out their ass.
Worse than that, actually. Well, maybe worse. I'm not sure. Because another thing they give you is the thing called nasia, which is essentially a nasal enema. So they put oils in that through your nose and clean you out that way. Then the rest of it is rather harmless. They got like a sweatshop where they give you heat treatments, massage, yoga, meditation, right? But I mean, some of the things he uses there, like he uses genuine Ayurvedic terms. Like he's got Agna, which is your digestive fires, right? Now, and so supposedly that's how you digest food, experiences, memories, and emotions. So when you're digesting things, again, it's shifting from physical to metaphysical in sort of a weird way. He goes on. He has other comments. He has a thing called Ama, which is improperly digested Ajni. I like how he's using all these terms because you don't really know what they mean, so they sound really spooky.
So, Don, if I get you what you're saying here, he's kind of taking a lot of what I imagine like folkloric terms that maybe have a historic meaning, a cultural meaning, but he's trying to give them like a scientific meaning.
Well, that, and he's taking them out of context. I mean, one of the reasons why he's using these is you don't really know what they mean, so they can really mean anything. I think one of the worst ways he does it, and I think he does this purely for profit motive, but who knows what's in his head, is he uses the word God. Now, Ayurvedic medicine is a form of Hinduism, right? It's not Western type stuff. It's not Christian type stuff. But he uses the word God. But his definition of God is the generator, organizer, and disseminator. But it's very hard to find any of that in his literature. And I'm quite sure the reason why he does that is if he uses God as the term, then it's okay for Christians to go and use this foreign Eastern type of stuff that might not seem properly Christian, but it sounds Christian because he says God, so it must be okay.
He's making it more palatable for a wider audience.
Well, why don't we lighten the palate right now and go to a commercial break. Back with more on Radio Free Thinker.
Yeah, the state of hip-hop right now, man, as far as the way I see it, I think right now hip-hop is advancing as far as skills. You got brothers, you know what I'm saying, getting like more witty.
There ain't nobody to be pretty for. Let it rattle, let the clatter kill him, let the cataclysm wash. Who really listens? Precision with a verse draws a cry. Draw a line between an easy melody and peace of mind.
You got DJs doing all kind of crazy shit on the turntables. I like where it's going, and I like, you know what I'm saying, the creative process that brothers is trying to take it to right now.
Rally Rails and Bread and Butter in the place to be. Crimes and Treasons Radio, 101.9 FM, Vancouver, CITR.ca, every Tuesday, 9 till 11.
Dynamite!
We're back now. Now, we were talking about Deepak Chopra and how he's a member of Big Alt Medicine, where he makes millions of dollars. He takes historical terms and he redefines them or manipulates them so he can get more people. But probably the worst area, the most egregious area I find, is how he misuses scientific terms. Deepak makes a fortune out of using the near understanding of people to peddle his woo-woo. Terms largely taken from quantum mechanics that he takes out of context and misinterprets them to promote the kind of things that he has to say. He has two really big claims that we're going to discuss here right now, or misuses of physics claims. One is what's called the observer effect. This effect states that in a quantum system, the system is indeterminate, or in what they call a superposition. Superposition kind of means that if I'm looking at an electron, it's orbiting the nucleus, and there's various orbits it can be in. And as long as it's not being absorbed, it can be treated as though it's orbiting all of those based on what they call a probability field. Now, probability field itself doesn't actually mean it's in every possible orbit. There's a certain probability it's going to be in orbit A, another probability in orbit B, and that creates what they call a probability wave. Now, in observing the electron, you kind of say, I see you, and you see its actual state. So it's no longer in this superposition. It actually collapses the waveform. What's the word I'm looking for?
Collapses the wave function.
Wave function, right. Collapses the wave function, and the electron kind of is in one particular state.
So this is normally illustrated with Schrodinger's cat. Schrodinger came up with this thought experiment to sort of explain this rather weird observer effect concept. And he says, imagine that there's a box in which you have a radioactive isotope that is in some state of decay, and it's poisonous, and you place a cat in the box. This was made up back in the 40s or 50s, where ethics were not so much in the way of doing physical thought experiments. But the radioactive isotope is radioactively decaying, and it may or may not have killed the cat at some point during which it was in the box. But because the lid is on the box, you don't know whether the cat is alive or dead. You just have some certain probability based on the rate of decay that you know for the radioactive isotope of which state it could be in, alive or dead. And it's only when you open the box that this probability collapses down to the actual state, because you found out whether it's alive or dead.
Now, it's important to note that it's not that it's actually in two states, although mathematically it can behave that way. And we're talking about quantum particles. Actually, the Schrodinger cat example is one of the ways that Deepak can take examples that are used to help identify quantum physics and misuse them, because it could never happen with Schrodinger cat. Quantum effects only occur in the quantum universe, in the very microscopic. And that's one of the things that Deepak does. Deepak says that quantum effects falsely occur on the macro scale. For example, he has one thing where he says that if nobody observes the moon, it doesn't exist. Which, I mean, we sit there and we think that sounds crazy, largely because it is crazy, but here, and I can quote you. He says, yet you see the moon in your consciousness. There was no moon till it was experienced in your consciousness. No consciousness, no moon. If I
can interrupt there, wasn't that from the debate with Michael Shermer and Sam Harris?
It was.
And didn't they look at him like he had just gone crazy? Like they kind of just, their jaws like dropped. And
well, can you blame them?
No.
You know, and the funny thing is, too, is that quantum mechanics seems so unusual to us. It seems so counterintuitive because it only occurs on the quantum scale. If it happened on the macro scale, like Deepak says it can, then it wouldn't seem so weird, because these sort of things would be happening all the time. Grandma would disappear and reappear. She'd be dead. She'd be alive all the time.
We'd evolve to understand it. The reason we can't understand really microscopic things or really big things is because they were never necessary for our survival. If they were, as Deepak seems to basically be saying, we'd probably have an intuitive sense to understand them with.
The other thing to note is that quantum mechanics is normally presented to the public as this thing that basically allows really weird things to happen on a quantum level. But because of the way people use these thought experiments and explain it to the public, lots of people only remember the quantum mechanics as a really weird part and forget about the only on a microscopic level part. So there are so many people that take this quantum mechanics allows weird things to happen and use it to justify their weird thing. Like, I remember when we were at the psychic fair last year, we've ran into so many booths there that were selling stuff with quantum in the name merely because it allowed them to say this doesn't work in any normal physical way because it uses quantum mechanics, which allows weird things to happen.
Another aspect of this too, and it'll relate to the next topic we're going to cover, is that how the wave field collapses is actually independent of our observation. So when we observe it, the waveform collapses. But we don't determine how it collapses. It has its own, like I say, probability field that determines how it collapses. But Deepak says, no, we can by will determine how it collapses. And that's how he interprets, by observing it, you change the system. Well, no, by observing it, you found out what the system was. You didn't actually change it. Which leads us to another aspect called quantum entanglement, another thing he loves to use. Now, quantum entanglement is an effect that occurs under a very specific set of circumstances where two particles do become entangled or connected. So if we produced two pairs of electrons, let's say by slamming an electron, two paired photons, let's say by slamming an electron and a proton together, we would get random spin on the photons. One would be of one spin, the other would be of the opposite spin. They're paired and they're actually entangled. Now, each photon will share these superposition, it shares a state of superposition. So both of them are positive and negative, opposite to each other, all through the situation. Now, when we observe one, it changes the state of the other, or we discover what the state of the other is perhaps a better way to do it. Because in the superposition, it's in both states. The act of observing allows us to determine what it is. When we observe one photon, we collapse the probability field of the other. Now, again, this is an interesting physics experiment, but all you're doing is you're observing the state of one. Because they're both paired, you know what they both are. You don't actually have to measure the other one, so the probability field no longer exists. They are connected, sort of. We're not sure how. But one, once you observed it, that connection's broken. So it only exists for one sort of bit of information. And two, it only exists under very specific things. Deepak takes this and he warps it a bit, because he says we're always entangled all the time, that it's a persistent state. That way there, our quantum states, we share sort of a consciousness. He's one of these Jungians who believe that there's a cosmic consciousness, that God is consciousness, consciousness is the universe.
That he sort of calls quantum consciousness, as I think he's referred to it before. But really, this is just that really old idea of pantheism, that everything in the universe is conscious, the universe is consciousness itself, and everything is connected. This isn't a new idea. He's just dressing it up with quantum mechanical terms to sell it to more people. Again, using scientific terminology to make it palatable, which just annoys the crap out of me.
But why would he do this to mislead people or whatever? He doesn't have any ulterior motive, would he?
Well, unlike Big Pharma, that's motivated purely by profit, Deepak Chopra gives away his books for free, and he doesn't.
No. He makes, how much did he make in 2007?
That was his salary, according to Forbes, $22 million for the year. That didn't include investments or any other things he might have.
Who's paying him?
Well,
own company.
Yeah, he has like a series of clinics. One clinic, anyhow. I don't know if that he's
but
got incorporated.
He's such a giving person. He gives people two lunches a day for 5 days for only $5,000.
No. This, according to it, and again, if you go to his website, maybe I misread it, but I'm pretty sure it's two lunches for the week. Now, I thought that was kind of weird, but maybe he's got a cafeteria, so he can get that little extra bit of money off the end.
Wow, that's rough. I can see how you'll lose weight in that program.
Well, not only that, honestly, I laughed when I imagined these people, especially someone who we consider, you know, to be kind of upper crust and fastidious and all that, going there expecting to get this daily bhajna, and then going, oh, what's this bhajna? Oh, it sounds so interesting. What is it? It's going to purify me. Bend over.
Radio Freethinker. Yeah. Well, that's awful. And I think it's important to realize, or actually I should point out, that some people are going to claim that you, Don, and you, Rob, and you, Daniel, and me, we're just Western ideological imperialists, and we're just tromping all over somebody's legitimate, folkloric understanding of how nature works. What makes our science any better than his mysticism?
I'm a libertarian. I don't trample over people.
Unless there's money in it.
Well, one, I mean, we tend to use the scientific terms as they were actually meant to be used. We use scientific process, right? So, I mean, we just don't say this. We actually have to try and prove it. And thirdly, from what I understand, Deepak doesn't have any clinics in India or anything like that. So It seems like his traditional Indian medicine doesn't sell well there, although I'm sure there's a home cottage industry that sells it.
Yeah, it's not that he's using traditional Indian Ayurveda and we are trampling over someone else's completely valid beliefs. It's that he's appropriating terms, redefining them for his own purposes, and misleading the public in this manner so that he can make money.
Well, sure set me straight. I hope it set our listeners straight. But if it didn't, please email us at radio.freethinker@gmail.com. We are running out of time, so we should go to our skeptical highlights of the week.
I have one that I thought was kind of interesting. This is, as a philosopher, there's the whole idea of philosophy of mind, and humans are conscious, animals may or may not be. Well, I saw articles swamping the web and some videos about a chimpanzee, old chimpanzee that had died, and its troop elicited what seemed to be mourning. It seemed to be carrying it at the last moment, and it seemed very human-esque. Now, of course, we do tend to attribute human properties to this, but the videotape seemed to be quite, and you can look at that videotape if you just do a Google search for chimp mourn Scotland BBC, and it should popped up for me first one, and you can read the article and you can see the video and you can make a decision for yourself. Were these chimpanzees aware of the life death difference? Did they actually mourn or care for someone who was going? It's quite interesting, I thought.
tomorrow night, the UBC Freethinkers are having a general meeting as well as watching a movie and then probably going to Skeptics in the Pub, which I assume will be one of Ethan's skeptical highlights.
Actually, I had forgotten all about Skeptics in the Pub.
Well, now I reminded him. And if you're listening on the podcast, that's May 5th. At 6, Buchanan B205, come out. I promise the meeting part will be short.
So this Friday, there's a conference going on at UBC called Northern Voice. And it's a conference mostly about bloggers, but there's also a panel or discussion or lecture or something on podcasting. There's a couple of other talks on all sorts of things related to basically using social media and the web to, you know, learn and spread your knowledge. And if you're interested in that, I highly recommend signing up. There might be a few tickets left. You'll see me there. And maybe we'll bring something back that we can use on the show or on our blog, which is at radiofreethinker.com.
I have two highlights. Well, I guess three, actually. The first highlight is actually a really neat webpage that I stumbled across today called Maps of War. I think this is just really cool. They take various maps of the world, and then they create these sort of flash animations to explain things like how often the Middle East has been conquered, the spread of democracy, all the religions, World War II stuff. Very neat. Check it out. www.mapsofwar.com. The most important highlight, however, is Cafe Inquiry, CFI's monthly discussion series. We're having it again this month, Monday, May 8th at 11 a.m. That's at SFU Harbor Center. You can check out our webpage for all the details. And the topic is going to be really neat. It's how you can have morals without God. So please check that out.
And I actually have one other thing. A lovely viewer of ours sent us an email about creating a dig... I go on Dig all the time. I can't think of what it's called. A Dig article on the website that you can vote up for us and hopefully bring us some new listeners. That's digg.com and just search for Radio Freethinker.
I dig it. This is Ethan, your freethinking historian and executive director of CFI Vancouver, saying goodnight.
This is Don telling our UK people to vote this Thursday.
This is Rob saying, may the 4th be with you.
This is Daniel saying, thanks for listening.
Are you looking for career information relevant to your arts degree? Come check out Work Your BA, a career workshop series specifically designed for art students. Find out what you can do with your major, learn how to improve your resume, discover the secrets to networking, and much, much more. For more information, visit www.arts.ubc.ca/students/workyourba.
Big government and big pharma have entered into a secret conspiracy in which secret government contracts are sold to big pharma that allow for secret chemicals to be placed in coffee seeds, all under the watchful eye of Big Coffee, who is secretly working with other world forces, all in a sinister plot to get alien embryos in our coffee so big pharma can sell us alien contraceptive pills. Or, if you'd rather get some rational news, check out Radio Free Thinker, the radio show/podcast that promotes